Welcome to Happy Talk with Michelle Happy. Using Buddhist principles to aid in recovery and help promote happiness. Michelle shares her experiences with guests dealing with addiction and codependency, among other things. Be prepared to learn something about yourself. This week's Michelle's guest is Rick Stagenborg, candidate for Senate in Oregon. Time now for Happy Talk.
Rick Stagenborg is running for U.S. Senator in Oregon, but he has a whole lot of other interesting aspects of him. He is a psychiatrist, and he's also a veteran. He's a peace advocate and has an interesting life. So, Rick, we're going to be talking about your life. Are you all settled in? I hope you're not going to be chewing food while we're talking.
No.
Okay.
And I'm ready to go.
Okay, good. And Chris, you're right here with me too, so if you need anything, just let me know. So Rick, tell me a little bit about your early life and your childhood, because, you know, I really think that our childhood really kind of sets us up for what we end up doing later on in life.
Well, I grew up in Portland, Oregon, in a Catholic family, a family that was intact. My parents were married the whole time I was growing up, and they still are. But my mother had been divorced, and I had six brothers and sisters.
A good Catholic family.
Uh-huh. I grew up with them. I'm not sure exactly what you're looking for if you want to ask more specific questions.
Well, so you had a basically a normal childhood, and you were a pretty normal kid?
Well, I thought so. Our idyllic existence sort of fell apart when I was 10 years old. At that point, my dad had sort of dragged us out of poverty and built a business, and he was doing well. But in 1968, my brother joined the Marines because he felt that was expected of him. My father's a veteran too, and that was just a given back then. He served a year in Vietnam, and he was a radioman, which, if anybody knows anything about what went on in Vietnam, it's a very dangerous job, going out on long-range patrols in the middle of the night, setting up listening posts while Vietnamese were walking by, hopefully by. He never talked about it, so I don't know exactly what his experience was.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of veterans, he just wanted to act like it never happened, but he wasn't able to when he first got back.
Wouldn't you say that's sort of a symptom of PTSD for men, you know, just not wanting to bring stuff up and talk about it?
It is, but it's even more so when it comes to talking about the war itself.
Uh-huh.
It's an experience that, according to DSM, is outside the realm of normal experience, and that's why it causes PTSD. It involves having your life constantly at risk, and also having other people's lives at risk that you feel responsible for. And then the final stressor, of course, is having to kill.
Right.
We're all brought up to believe that thou shalt not kill, and then we're told by our government that we have to go kill. We don't have it. During the Vietnam War, they didn't have a choice except to go to Canada or prison, and I know people that have done both.
Mm-hmm.
And I personally respect them just as much. It was not an easy decision for any of them. My brother probably would have liked to do that, but he felt he couldn't. So he went off to war, and I don't know what he did. I just know he was wounded towards the end.
Are you speaking about your brother now?
He stepped on a mine and he took some shrapnel to the head. So when he came home, he was very angry at my father for basically expecting him to go. And my mother became very angry at my father. I recall him confronting my father, just screaming at him. And then within a few days, I heard he had stuck a gun in his mouth.
So your brother killed himself?
Well, no, he didn't commit suicide. He attempted suicide, but I assume his hand was shaking since he's a trained killer. And he missed his spinal cord by about a half an inch to an inch.
Oh, man.
I saw the wound when he got out of the hospital 3 months later. By then he had calmed down. But he probably would have gone back and killed himself again if it wasn't for his wife.
Mm.
She kept him alive.
Wow.
But he's still pretty messed up. I don't think he ever sought services back then. There wasn't much available for combat veterans. They really didn't understand how to treat PTSD. It wasn't even an official diagnosis until 1980. So he went to work for my father and became very quiet and withdrawn, extremely quiet and withdrawn. He was had wanted to be a physics major. Pretty brilliant. He, on his own, studied physics and astronomy. When he got back, he sort of buried himself between his work and his books. Didn't have any friends, so that's about all he did.
And what was your relative?
Excuse me?
What was your relative age to your brother?
I was 10. He was 10 years older. He was
okay.
20 when he got back.
So you were little.
Or 21.
You were pretty little when all this was going on.
Yeah, but I was fully aware of what was going on. Your younger listeners need to realize that this is all piped into our living rooms by television back then, when the news was more open and they felt people had a right and a need to know what was going on. Not like it is today where war is a sanitized, hidden thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, it affected me very much. I knew what was going on. I didn't know exactly what was going on with him. And the thing is, everybody that goes to war fights their own private war. They don't know what's going on in other places. They're shut off from most of the media. Although, our Iraq and Afghanistan vets are treated to Fox News daily in the mess hall. We've seen the pictures on TV. As far as I know, that's probably all they ever saw.
Right. Yeah, I remember.
Except when they went on the internet.
Uh-huh. I do remember the news during the Vietnam War, and they did show a lot of stuff. It was...
Oh, yeah, and they also showed the coffins coming home, and that was on TV, too.
Yeah, and so you...
And that same year that he went to war, they showed Robert F. Kennedy being assassinated. They showed Martin Luther King being assassinated. Janis Joplin died of a heroin overdose.
Yep.
I mean, people were dying right and left, but at the same time, there was an atmosphere of hope. I mean, people were angry about the war, but they were hopeful they could change it. There were mass movement of people out in the streets. Nothing like today, where people just quietly mutter to themselves or their friends and are afraid to confront people. Though I'm not afraid to confront people.
So we're talking about.
And I can't continue.
At this point, Rick, we're talking about the late '60s, early '70s, right?
Right. That was the height of the anti-war movement during when Nixon was being reelected.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me, when Nixon was elected the first time, I mean.
Right. And you're how old at this point?
I was 10.
Okay.
When Nixon was reelected the first time.
Okay. So you ended up going to college, and how did you decide to become a psychiatrist?
Well, you know how it is, Michelle. You're in mental health field.
Well, I do.
We're trying to figure out how to fix ourselves. Although, I think, you know, I've heard in alternative theories, we're learning how to fix our families.
Right.
And I think that's really what I wanted to do.
Well, it sounds like there was, a lot of trauma right inside your family. And, you know, I think, and I know it was true for me, that I I need to figure stuff out. When I can figure stuff out, then I can accept it. So I think that's one of the reasons I studied psychology, so that I could make sense out of all of the questions I had about my own family of origin. So
right, and I also suffered depression from about then, probably to the time I was about 30. Most of the time, often than not.
From age 10 to 30, or from age your college age?
10 to 30.
Oh, wow. Probably. Yeah.
If you don't mind, Michelle, I had to leave my computer inside, not realizing how far away I was going to have to go. There'll be a little noise on the line, but I'm going to go get
okay.
the computer and bring it back.
Okay, that's fine.
We can keep talking.
This is citizen journalism, so all kinds of... I'm holding the phone away. What's that? Oh, well. I'm holding the...
Can you repeat that, or should I just talk since you can probably hear me better?
Yeah, you can keep talking.
Okay, so, yes, I went to college. Because of my depression, I almost didn't until my father sat me down and asked me, you know, if I really wanted to make a decision like that, or did I want to keep my options open. And that just totally changed my opinion of the decision I was about to make. I wanted to just wander around the country and try to figure out what was so wrong with it. But because I did choose to go to college, I ended up having that opportunity later. So I've been all through America many times, into Europe, into Mexico, been to Canada, seen the poor people in other countries, and the rich people enjoying themselves on vacation. And the contrast has always bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway.
And at some point, you joined the military, right? When was this?
Yeah, that's jumping ahead a little bit.
Okay.
I wanted to say I went to college for 8 years because, like you, I like to figure stuff out. I took all the math and science I could get. I took all the psychology classes I could get. I surveyed all the social sciences and natural sciences, studied calculus, modern physics. And this is relevant because it all plays into the book I'm writing online, the Book of Essays, that explains all this stuff in much more detail. It explains my historical perspective of how we got so messed up as a country and a people, and what's been happening to the world, and how we can fix it. Despite the fact that we're talking about a very depressing subject, I have always believed, having been brought up in a religious family, that good would triumph over evil in the end.
So
I can't believe that.
You're basically an optimist, huh?
Yes, I'm very much an optimist. People call me Pollyanna all the time.
Wait, have you heard the joke about the pessimist and the optimist? Twins are taken to the psychiatrist, and one is a very sunny kid, and the other is rather dour. And so the psychologist says, I want to try an experiment. So he puts the very dour, sort of depressed kid in a room full of just the best toys you can imagine. And then he puts the other kid, the sunny kid, in a room with a pile of horse manure. And of course, there's the one-way mirror, or is that called a two-way mirror? I'm not sure. But so they're observing these twins, and the depressed kid was just sitting with his chin in hands, looking at the.
Whoa, you just cut out.
Oh, okay. I'm going to keep talking, though. Can you hear me now?
Okay.
Yeah. So the kid just had his chin in his hands looking at all these toys, and the psychologist comes in and says, why aren't you playing with all these beautiful toys? And the kid says, well, I know these are not my toys. I know this is some sort of experiment, and if I started enjoying them and playing with them, eventually you'd come in and take me away, so why bother? So then it's not over. And so then the psychologist goes into the the kid's room with the pile of horse manure and a shovel. And that kid is shoveling that horse manure like you wouldn't believe. And the psychologist says, why are you shoveling all this horse manure? And the kid says, with a pile of horse manure this big, there's got to be a horse in here somewhere.
I've never heard the whole thing, but I've heard the punchline in a different version.
Right, right. And so, you know, it sounds to me like you grew up, if you had depression from when you were 10 until you were 30, you were probably that kid in the room full of toys.
Well, sort of. I guess I'm a little different because I always believed that things would work out in the end someday, maybe not in my lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, after studying, like I said, I went to college for 8 years. Then I went to medical school for 4 years. Then I went through a residency training program. And I learned so much from talking to other people that I really felt to begin, or I began to feel that I understood what was going on, my purpose in the world. And I became a much happier person.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem I hadn't worked through was my anger. I've always been terribly angry when I see grave injustice.
So
it wasn't until I started looking at my faith and questioning my lack of faith that I began to see things differently, and I think I pretty much worked through my anger.
So you work through your anger through your faith, and are you saying that's the Catholic faith, or do you have a more...
No.
Okay.
What happened was, when I was 10 years old, my dad asked me to take Catholic confirmation training classes, and I went, oh, goody, I get to learn so much more now, and I started going to these classes, and I'm finding out that there's this thing called dogma I never heard from the priest before, and I was kind of shocked. I started asking questions, and they frankly didn't want to discuss it, and I wasn't shocked anymore. I was just put off, and I go, oh, I get it. This is a brainwashing cult. And so I walked away. I quit going. My dad accepted it because he's a good American. He believes that people need to make their own decisions, even though that is the way my brother felt. Maybe he'd learned something in the meanwhile. I don't know. But I walked away from religion, and frankly, although I didn't give up on trying to practice what I learned, I didn't really think much about religion. I struggled with the concept of whether there was really a God, and ultimately decided that the answer to that question it matters, but you come to the same conclusion either way if you really care about people, and that is that our purpose on earth is to help other people.
Right, to be of service.
So that's what I do. I became a doctor and joined the Army in order to pay for my medical education. I was tired of being a poor student after all those years, and I wanted to move out of my parents' house. So you're
one of the many who joined the military for financial reasons or economic reasons. Uh-huh.
Although I did have a lot of concern, of course, for veterans because of what happened to my brother. And so in my military training, I had the opportunity to care for veterans and active duty from all services. I was lucky enough, well, not lucky enough, I sort of arranged it. I was stationed in Hawaii, and that was a wonderful duty, obviously. But I learned really, I got really good training in neurology, and amazingly enough, it was a psychodynamically oriented program, meaning that we really looked at theories of personality and motivation and development, and particularly the concept of developmental lines. To understand how a person develops, you really have to look at a number of different areas where people develop over their life and look at where they get arrested to find out where the psychological pathologies are. Just an amazing, mind-blowing experience, and to get it in the military.
That's incredible.
I think I was quite fortunate to get in that program. I really didn't even realize they were that type of a program, but I always wanted to be a psychotherapist, not a pill pusher.
Uh-huh.
I actually got a psychology degree, and I wanted to be a clinical psychologist, but I didn't get even, or I only got one answer out of all the programs I applied to, so I just kind of got disgusted with that process. Having been almost a 4-point student and having such a broad educational background, I was pretty disgusted with the fact that they didn't even consider me as a candidate and try to find out who I was.
Well, I guess
that's when I decided to become a teacher. And being side by side with a bunch of pre-med students, I decided, hey, I can still do psychotherapy. I just become a psychiatrist, and I have the option of using medications when it's appropriate.
Which is, if I could just say a little something about that, you know, the most of the psychiatrists that I deal with and refer to basically are doing med checks. You know, they're prescribing medication and you know, just kind of keeping it at that. There aren't that many psychiatrists that enjoy doing the actual psychotherapy. So,
well, I read a study that says that part of the problem is that a lot of programs don't even teach it anymore. St. Louis University, or whatever it is in St. Louis, is very proud of their brain research and how they're going to figure out everything about people who study the brain. Well, that's a pretty stupid exercise, and if you studied psychology, you understand it, because you would have studied Descartes and the mind-body split question. The point being that you can't possibly understand how a person thinks or their behavior, which is what we're trying to alter, simply by studying the brain, because the brain is nothing but a tool for the mind.
Right. And in Buddhist terms, you know, our karma, which is all of the culmination of all of our lives, including this life and our childhood in this life, really has such an effect on what we become interested in, what we're talented at. And the brain is an organ.
Right.
Interesting.
And the thing is, the mind is an epiphenomenon of the brain. It arises from the brain, just like if you're into science fiction like I am, artificial intelligence arises from computer programs in these scenarios. When the programs develop a certain level of complexity, they become self-aware.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what's happened in the animal kingdom, too, and that's what ended up producing humans eventually.
That's interesting.
That's pretty well accepted.
And so you're talking about sort of a universal consciousness that can be realized.
Well, that's a different thing. And that's something I've really only come to relatively recently appreciate. Like religious experience, I think you can really only understand that if you've experienced it in your own life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very personal thing.
Mm-hmm. Very true.
So I guess that leads to one of the epiphanies I had relatively recently, really. I'd always wanted to believe in God, but I couldn't, until I defined God in a way that I could accept. And that is, I kind of always suspected God was our, like you said, collective consciousness or unconsciousness. I believe that the unconscious can become conscious, and Freud showed us some of the ways you can do that. There are a lot of other ways. William James wrote about the varieties of religious experience and how you can achieve some contact with that collective unconsciousness through meditation, certain psychoactive substances, brain injuries. There's all kinds of ways that you can be in touch with the universal unconsciousness, but when you're really open to it, it becomes consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe it has an independent existence, consciousness. So I don't call it the universal unconscious. I call it the universal consciousness.
Well, and
we're just not always aware of it. And when we become aware of it, we see evidence of it everywhere I have in my own belief system.
Right. And, you know, and I'm a Buddhist, so I'll just insert here a little bit of Buddhist philosophy. But in Buddhism, there is a intelligence that we can all, it isn't separate from us. It's really our job through one of the things you didn't mention, which is meditation. Is to...
I did mention that.
Oh, okay. I thought you said medication.
not medication. That dulls your ability to experience
it,
the universe.
It certainly does. I think so, too. So, you know, our job is to realize that intelligence and consciousness within us, you know, it's a matter of allowing it and encouraging it to ripen within us through acts of compassion and meditation and study and practice and discipline and all that, all of that. And that's what we call in Buddhism the Buddha nature.
Right, and ultimately you have to experience the death of the ego
before
you immerse yourself in the eternal one. And this is, I think, what Jesus divined too. Which is that, you know, if you begin with the premises that we are all equal, we are all beloved of the Son, connected by the Holy Spirit, you come to the same conclusion.
He said,
and you can do the same thing as a humanist, only it's a heck of a lot more difficult.
Right.
They tend to reject a lot of these concepts.
Well, Jesus said, it's not me, but the God within me that does the works, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And he is a servant.
Right.
He was a servant.
Yes. And I think in Buddhist terms, we would call him at least a bodhisattva, maybe a Buddha.
I'm studying Buddhism intensively, but I think of him as an enlightened soul, just like Buddha.
Very much so, yeah.
And I also think that Muhammad was an enlightened soul.
Mm-hmm.
He was in a different situation than Jesus. The Israelis were enslaved by the Romans. Some of them went more or less willingly. I call the Sanhedrin the Quislings of their day. They went along with it because they were some of their power, and that's all they really cared about. Whereas Jesus rejected the concept of being enslaved and told what to do by another power. The only power he wanted to listen to was God, and he tried to teach other people that. When they caught on, and he built up a movement, that's what scared both the Israelis, Sanhedrin, and other authorities, Herod, perhaps also Pilate, although there's some disagreement on that. The historical record's not really that clear. So anyway, Muhammad was in a different situation. He lived in a time when the real slavery was a tribal mentality that kept people separate from each other, fighting over water. So he took Jesus' teachings. He regarded Jesus as a valid prophet, one of the greatest prophets. He took his teachings and he taught them to others, but that same reason it caused Jesus a problem, it also caused him a problem. The leaders in Mecca decided that they wanted to take him out. And they actually asked for permission to kill him. They asked his uncle permission to kill him. His uncle refused, but he found out, you know, he realized he was in danger. His whole family was in danger, so he left. He went to Medina. But they built up an army, and they were going to wipe out the entire settlement. When Muhammad said, no, if you're not going to let us even leave, then we have to fight. And it was a different situation than Jesus. The Israelis couldn't fight the Romans. They just simply couldn't. If they all decided at once to fight, they couldn't have beat them. They didn't have the power. But in Muhammad's case, he just said, well, we have to fight anyway. We can't let this die. It's too important. So I think Muhammad were both soldiers for peace.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the first two, but I doubt it. There were probably earlier ones that just didn't have the lasting effect on millions of people that those two prophets had.
Well, and it really.
So anyway, Muhammad. Here, I just want to make this one more
sure,
point.
Sure.
Muhammad fought with a small band of his followers, who were, I'm told, mostly old men and younger men. They went out and fought a much larger, much better equipped, much better trained army, and they fought him to a standstill long enough that other people started caring about it, and they came to join them. And they eventually defeated this army. And instead of going in and wiping them out and taking their wives as sexual slaves and their children as slaves, he did something different. He forgave them and asked them to join him, and they did. And this movement spread all over the known world to Constantinople, as far as Constantinople to the west, and then basically to the borders of the Mongol Empire to the east.
Mm-hmm.
And so, if they're both prophets, what are we fighting about, you know? They were both trying to tell us the same thing, and Muhammad accepted Jesus. Why can't we accept Muhammad?
Right.
Who says there's only one prophet? Who says that is God, and he's the only one?
Well,
that's crazy.
Actually,
there were prophets before Jesus. Why couldn't there be prophets after Jesus?
You know, it's really interesting because Christianity, I think, is the only religion that says there is only one. And actually, that one isn't, the human one is Jesus and the other one is God. And for most of Christianity, God is something external.
Well, they say they're one and the same. God manifested as Jesus to save the chosen people, but I think that's a crazy idea.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in Buddhism, if I understand it correctly, they say we're all manifestations of God. We're all avatars.
We're all
our true self.
Well, in Buddhism, they say we're all interconnected. You know, we're all interdependent,
right.
And there is no dependent. I mean, there is no independent arising. So,
right. I guess I was confusing two different concepts.
Right.
What I mean to say is, if there's a heaven, if you accept that premise, and if we are spirit connected to it, there's no reason to think that we can't exist in both places at the same time.
Right.
We're bounded. Our consciousness is bounded by four-dimensional space.
Yes.
But that if heaven exists, it is apparently a different dimension. And there's no reason that we can't exist both. If we exist in fifth-dimensional space, there's no inherent logical conflict if it existing at the same time in fourth-dimensional space. We just can't directly perceive the fifth dimension of our true self.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's and you know, in Buddhism there are many Buddhas. There is not just one Buddha. There are many, many Buddhas. They're both male and female, and it's all just about becoming awake.
Right, and that's another problem I have with the traditional interpretation of the Bible. Jesus is the God, and that means God is a male, and that's nuts. That leaves out half the human race. We are created in God's image. That includes women, too. They have to include women in the concept of God.
I would think so.
Of course. I mean, and there's all kinds of, you know, rationalization. But it does. It just doesn't make logic.
Right, right. It is interesting how they say in Christianity that you just have to take things on faith, and for people who are very, very critical thinkers, that's a little bit of a difficult pill to swallow at times.
That's why I don't consider myself a Christian. I study all the great religions,
right?
And try to figure out what makes sense when you put it all together.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like the story of the 12 blind monks revealing different parts of an elephant, trying to describe what an elephant is.
Right.
When they communicate with each other, then they can grok the whole, the essence of the thing, the platonic form. But if you're not even listening to people who are describing other aspects of the same thing, then you're never going to figure out what the whole thing is. It's like kind of like a holograph. You have to look at it from different angles to really understand the entirety of it.
And that's exactly what interdependence is. that everything is connected and it is a hologram. It's
right.
Very, very
and
interesting.
I find Hinduism just fascinating because it's a different way of looking at the same thing.
Right.
People think that Hinduism is a polytheistic religion. It is not. It's a monotheistic religion. Vishnu is God. But everything, all these other so-called gods in the pantheon are actually just manifestations of the one God.
Mm-hmm. So the way I used to be more into Christianity, and I used to think of myself as like the cell in the nail, the fingernail of God, one cell in the fingernail of God, in order to sort of explain to myself how it all worked in terms of interconnectedness.
So, that's the only way I can put it together. Here's another piece of my own personal, I guess you could call it religion. It's the beliefs that I guide my life by. I suspect that space-time is bounded and closed, and that would explain why the Bible says God is the Alpha and the Omega. There's no beginning and no end, and that's why God exists at that point. But God is not fully formed at other points in four-dimensional space because we create God, and because our consciousness exists in the fifth dimension also, and if our collective consciousness is God, then God is helping us do it, perfecting God's self.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do that by collectively making moral decisions, and only when all of us have arrived at, let's say, enlightenment, are we going to realize the old, are we going to collectively realize the nature of reality in the fifth dimension, and that's when heaven comes to earth, as is asked, you know, begged for in the Lord's Prayer. Thy will be done on earth.
As it is in heaven.
And thy kingdom will come to earth. And I believe what that means is the fifth dimension will collapse into the fourth dimension. They'll become one.
It's interesting because you're speaking in terms of concepts that are a little bit foreign in Buddhism, because in Buddhism there is no dualism. There is no self or other. So the concept of metaphor is as much reality as what we would consider physical reality. And
right. Well, this split between mind and body, this split between self and other, these are all illusory in reality, but most of us don't understand the nature of reality.
Right.
That's what I'm saying.
And we call that delusion. In Buddhism.
Well, now, wait a minute. You know, the technical definition of delusion is a belief system that's contrary to evidence of your senses, unless a lot of other people believe it. That's not a delusion.
Now, that's the psychiatric. Right, that's the psychiatric definition of delusion.
Well,
it's not the Buddhist one. Yeah, yeah. And so, very interesting, and you and I could go on for a long time, but I think would bore our listeners if we went on too long. And so I want to hear more. You know, you mentioned about Jesus being a soldier for peace. And I want to hear more, a little bit more about what happened to you when you were in the military. You were functioning as a psychiatrist and treating people. And so does that mean you did not see any active, I mean, did you, well, just explain more what you did.
Okay. Well, what happened was I was in my training program in Tripler, and I got on my general surgery rotation. And I encountered this chief resident who was really a dunderhead, and I don't think really invested in taking care of the patients. He just wanted to learn how to be a surgeon so he could go out and do surgery.
And make money.
Sort of approached the job like a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
I, on the other hand, being more attuned to the whole patient, was just shocked by the mistreatment and maltreatment and the ignoring of important problems the patients were facing. I mean, problems that were relevant to healing them. And I tried to do my best to explain this to him when we're on rounds. He wouldn't listen. He'd get irritated, say, why are you wasting your time on that? You should be in surgery holding retractors, or waiting in line to hold retractors. You should be doing some gut work and making sure your notes are written before I ask for them. And I didn't want to get in conflict with him, but I knew I had to take care of patients. It was my moral responsibility as a doctor. So I just did it, and I just let the conflict build and build until he started pressuring me more and more. I started getting really concerned, alarmed about myself personally, thinking, my God, if I can't do this, these people won't be protected. So I started taking a lot on myself that an intern really shouldn't be responsible for, and eventually I started becoming scared I was going to make mistakes, so I indulged in a rationalization that I could do more than I really was capable of, and I started rounding when I wasn't even on duty to look for more patients that were being abused, and I found them, and I documented them, and that's what really led to things coming to a head. So ultimately, I was under so much pressure that my judgment failed, and I started making, like I said, assumptions that were not based on facts and evidence, and because that led to nothing serious, but it led to, you know, obviously I had a problem. They sent me to a psychiatric hospital for an evaluation.
So tell me what you were going through personally and your symptoms and what was happening with you at that point.
Well, I basically saw myself as trying to do the job I'd been trained for and having to fight the authority directly above me. And it wasn't a problem with the whole system. It was really just one guy who refused to understand where I was coming from, refused to accommodate, refused to consider anything things that I told them about what the patients needed, and I knew they needed it. I don't think I was wrong about that. And in fact, the patient almost died at his hands. When I was fully capable of saving her, I knew what needed to be done, but because I felt like I had to ask permission, he got involved and almost killed her.
Wow.
That was the last straw for me. That really was the last straw. I mean, it's one thing to abuse patients, cause them unnecessary pain, ignore what they really need.
Right.
But it's another thing to almost kill somebody right in front of me when I was trying to save her.
So are you saying that you kind of broke at that point?
In a sense, I didn't fully break, but I lost my perspective and started doing things that ultimately interfered with my ability to do what I was really trying to do, which was take care of the patient. So it wasn't inappropriate of them to question it. I guess I can't really say they did anything inappropriate at all except this one individual. Not that I'm trying to blame everything on him, but, that's the only way I can make sense of what happened. But they did try to send me back to duty, but I hadn't lost my sense that I was being watched and I was going to be, you know, judged harshly for any little mistake.
So
I fell right back into the same habits.
Right.
Ended up being discharged because of that.
Well, so were they saying, you said you went to a psychiatric hospital as a patient, right?
Twice.
And
I was in my own hospital briefly.
And
with my patient.
Wow.
That's a pretty bizarre situation.
Must have been. And so what was the diagnosis that you were given?
Sorry?
What was the diagnosis that you were given?
Initially, they thought I had narcissistic personality disorder because I tried to tell them, you know, yes, I did know things that they didn't know. Yes, I did know more than my chief resident. I actually knew things my attending didn't know, and he said so.
Yeah.
But they didn't believe that.
So they thought you had delusions of grandeur, huh?
Yes, they call that not delusion, but the grandiosity.
Uh-huh. Okay.
They thought, ultimately, they concluded, well, I'm not manic, so it must be that it's a personality disorder.
Uh-huh.
Common fallback position when they can't pigeonhole you.
Right. So that was the initial...
And when I went back and did the same things and actually was even more out there than then they decided I was manic, and they discharged me, giving me a 30% disability, which I'm still rated at 30%, even though I haven't really had any serious problems since I started taking medication regularly, getting involved in psychotherapy, and really exploring my spirituality. I think of those two, I think that studying spirituality and coming to some personal decisions about what the nature of God and our relationship to each other and what my moral duties were, I learned to calm myself, and I really think that's what was driving this hypomania / mania.
Right.
And my uncontrolled anger.
Yeah. Let me explain just a little bit about the difference between hypomania and mania. With mania, and you can, you know, I mean, you can jump in, of course, but with mania, you're talking about somebody who is very grandiose, is very, like, hyped up, doesn't feel the need to sleep, is, like, incredibly euphoric, can go out and do crazy things like sleeping with numerous people or going out gambling, thinking they're going to be able to win. And it looks really crazy.
Well, not always. There's a whole variety of manifestations of bipolar disorder in the hypomanic / manic phase. It's really a matter of degree. And even in a manic patient, there's quite a bit of variability.
Sure, because
sometimes you don't recognize mania until you really start talking to somebody.
Right, because oftentimes mania can be in incredible irritability, too.
Right. And that typically, that's when the high starts to fade.
That's when the high starts to fade.
Cycle after cycle, you can be chronically irritable. And it can be difficult to distinguish mania from depression in people who chronically suffer from both.
Right.
Because the symptoms start to intermingle, and you can become what they call mixed.
Mixed.
That's very, very difficult to treat.
And it can be very dangerous, too. In terms of,
yes, you can. That's the highest rate of suicide.
The highest rate, exactly. And then hypomania is a sort of moderated version. It's a lesser amount of the same issue.
It can precede mania, or it can be the only manifestation on the upside.
Right.
If you want to call it that.
And then
people can go through their whole life cycling back and forth between them. These are the people we call bipolar two.
Bipolar two.
Term, because what most psychiatrists don't understand is that if you look at it from a psychological model or a biopsychological model, all you're really looking at is imbalance between the arousal systems of the brain and the frontal lobe's ability to control them.
Mm-hmm.
In the manic phase, your arousal systems are totally out of control.
Right.
In the severely depressed phase,
no governor.
Your frontal lobe has worked so hard to suppress this agitation that you exhaust yourself and you become lethargic and you sleep all the time. And you have typical severe depressive symptoms.
And so
if you learn how to modulate your arousal and keep it at an optimal level, you can actually be incredibly highly functioning.
Uh-huh.
I don't consider my bipolar disorder a disease. It's simply, I simply have certain biological characteristics that give me the potential to become incredibly aroused or incredibly depressed. But I've learned how to keep my mind in such a space that I don't fall into either one anymore.
And that's...
Like I said, I'm not sure that the medications are necessary, but it's not like I'm going to stop on my day.
Right.
Continue to take them to be
right.
safe.
Right. And what you're talking about is mindfulness. And I think the same thing is true with attention deficit disorder, that if you have ADD, it's important to figure out a way to live your life such that your ADD enhances your life. And you can.
That's what Tom Harbin says.
Yes.
Dean Adele says.
Yes.
They're both right, because they've taken the time to really study it and try the techniques that arise from thinking about it that way. And they
right.
work.
That's right.
He was the most severe ADHD patient.
And Tom Hartman hasn't just studied it. He is ADHD. So, and
I know. So Dean Adele says he is, too.
Yeah.
Learn how to not just deal with it, but actually excel because of it.
Well,
I frankly think ADHD and and bipolar disorder are related.
Well, because the H part, the hyper part, is sometimes very difficult to distinguish from mania or hypomania. And then
right. Borderline personality disorder and PTSD from childhood sexual abuse are also related.
That's right.
They're also imbalances of arousal and suppression by the frontal lobe.
And in PTSD, we call that activation or numbing. So this makes a lot of sense what you're saying, that it's that arousal, and what's the opposite called of arousal?
That's just a term I came up with.
Well, I like
I've never actually read about it. I think it's from suppression of arousal. It's a feedback mechanism. The frontal lobe tries to fight this overwhelming anxiety that comes with that kind of arousal by suppressing it through natural neural mechanisms. But if the arousal is strong enough and you really fight it, you know, because of the consequences of the behavior that's coming out, then you end up depressing yourself.
Exactly.
It's not homeostatic.
Right.
Yet what you're really doing is trying to train a patient to, through mindfulness, use their mind to establish a homeostasis between these two processes.
Right. And in the mindfulness process, what you're doing is you're trying to step out of your own consciousness just a touch. You're not to become dissociated or detached, but to be able to have to be somewhat the observer of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a wonderful tool.
I think that is, mindfulness is a concept, as far as I know, that came out of Linehan, that particular term.
Yes.
You know, Marshall Das called it being here now,
right,
which is a Buddhist concept, basically.
And you're speaking of, one second.
So these things are all related, and I use all different metaphors to explain it to my patients, depending on where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
This is really where I first started becoming interested in religion, was by talking to my patients about their religious beliefs and realizing, oh my God, these guys are on something I never thought about.
And let me just add that when you say Linehan, you're talking about Marsha Linehan, who has, she's developed something called dialectic behavior therapy for borderline personality disorder, which utilizes Buddhist techniques of meditation and mindfulness. And she herself has been diagnosed with borderline personality disorder. So,
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, you know, I hate these labels.
Oh, me too.
Pigeonholing. We're so much more alike than different. And
yes.
Our commonalities are much more important than our differences.
Yes.
If psychiatrists understood that, they would get away from this Freudian model of duality between the patient and the doctor.
Right.
And realize what they're doing is because they're of identifying with the patient, they never really are able to understand the patient's experience.
Yep, you're so right. And I consider what I call the client-therapist relationship a sacred relationship. It is one of the most intimate relationships you will ever have. And my role as a therapist is to be a mentor and a teacher, and I consider myself just a few steps ahead in terms of my own awareness and mindfulness.
Right. The yin and yang of therapist and client is that you learn from each other in a cybernetic fashion.
Right.
And you may know more about the theory, but they know their experience. And if you really want to understand the variety of human experience, you have to put yourself in their place. Listen with the third eye. It's one of the books I read
right.
Talks about it. You need to use all your senses to pick up on the nonverbal and verbal communication. You need to continuously ask yourself, am I really understanding this? Is what they're seeing right at this moment? Does that make sense in terms of the assumptions I already made? This is how you learn about other people's experiences. It's the only way you can understand, because you can never actually the same person.
That's right.
Even if you're enlightened, you can't directly experience another person's experience. You have to learn how to communicate carefully.
Right.
And be a listener. Be receptive to to what they're trying to tell you.
So,
you can ask clarifying questions and ask for feedback to see if you still got it.
Right. So
that's communication.
How many hours of sleep do you get a night? I'm just thinking about, you need a little mania to be able to do everything that you do.
Well, believe me, I get exhausted for 4 to 8 hours, but I normally sleep 6 to 7.
Uh-huh.
7, typically.
Uh-huh.
Just depends on how busy I am. I don't always allow myself 7 hours. So I get tired like everybody else.
Right,
I don't have an abnormal level of energy. I just use my energy effectively. I'm pretty efficient at what I do.
And you quit the VA. You were a psychiatrist for the VA, and you had to resign in order to run for office. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Because you can't work for the government and run for office at the same time. Is that the deal?
That's correct.
Okay. And so let's just briefly, we're a little bit over an hour now. You know, we're not constrained by time so much, but I, you know, mostly about what people can take in terms of how long the show is.
Well, we are constrained by time and space, though.
Well, yes, that's true, Rick.
That's a little Buddhist joke.
Yeah, yeah. And I heard a little chuckle there from Chris, too, so. So tell me a little bit about your run for Senate.
Well, I started my political involvement in the single-payer movement. Since I missed out during the Vietnam War on joining all the hippies going out there and protesting.
Yeah, you were too little.
I got shortchanged.
Yeah.
So when Obama got elected and started talking about real health care reform, I said, well, darn it, I'm going to get out there and make sure people know what real health care reform is. I've been a member of Physicians for a National Health Plan for a number of years, but I've never been actively involved because it seemed pretty pointless with Bush in office. So, but when Obama got elected, I got very active, and I immediately hit the wall of congressional indifference. And I realized that before the debate even started, they'd already set up the fiction that public option was what everybody wanted. And they started brainwashing people who were staunch progressives. They started brainwashing them into thinking, well, this is the best we can get, so this is what we'll try to get.
At least they tried to brainwash us.
Pardon?
At least they tried to brainwash us. It never worked for me.
Well, right. They didn't brainwash all of us.
Right.
Unfortunately, we split the movement. So people that really wanted single payer went out and took their marching orders from Rahm Emanuel. And, this harebrained scheme to start out with a compromise and then expect to get something useful, it's brain dead. But it's not really stupid. It results from the assumption that senators can't work against the interest of the corporations to buy the propaganda campaign to put them in office in the first place. This is what happens when you trust professional politicians,
right,
who just buy into that assumption. Mm. I mean, we have to get rid of professional politicians. If somebody wants to be a lifelong politician, they better be serving the people like Bernie Sanders.
Right. Correct. I agree. He's one of my heroes. And so you decided out of that frustration to just run yourself.
Yes, I got to thinking about that early on because I could see that we were never going to get single payer unless people like me ran for office. And I considered running as a Democrat, but it was pretty pointless because my opponent is a 30-year veteran of the Senate. He's got lots of big money backers. He's proven his loyalty to the corporations that put him in office, and he's shown his willingness to betray the unions and other people that vote for him and used to work for him before they gave up on him. But I think we have a tremendous opportunity now to get people to understand that voting for a third-party candidate is not only the only way you can usefully vote and have a voice.
Right.
We have to let them know that we understand that Democrats and Republicans are the yin and yang of the corporate machine.
Of the oligarchy.
They're just tools of the puppet masters
that
run the corporations and want to run the world.
So you're in the Green Party.
Yes, Pacific Green in Oregon, but it's part of the National Green Party, right?
Uh-huh. And so this is just a further manifestation of your desire to be of service and to help people.
Yes.
That's wonderful.
Absolutely. I in the military, I regarded myself as a servant of the service members and the veterans and the people that were paying my salary. And I still regard myself, I was a county employee and a federal employee, and I still regarded myself as a servant of my patients and the taxpayers that paid my salary.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to continue to serve, but now I want to serve the whole country. Pay the taxpayers back for
carrying me all those years. Tell us the name of your book.
It's called Stop the Madness, The Diary of a Soldier for Peace and the War to Take Back America. It's available online as it's being written. It's a collection of essays. There's about 80 essays now, and they form a logical sequence. And what I'm trying to do is explain basically my view of reality, or at least present-day reality and past as I see it and the future as I envision it. Using these concepts that I'm talking about here, there's spiritual concepts, scientific concepts, psychological concepts, mathematical concepts.
Mm-hmm.
I draw pretty much on my whole well of knowledge to write this book and try to explain from what I like to call the holographic perspective.
Right. I was just going to say it sounds like a holistic approach. Sam, that's what it is. And you also have a Facebook page.
Mm-hmm. I have a Facebook page. There's my Stegenborg for Senate Facebook. There's my personal Facebook. There's Soldiers for Peace International Facebook. And then there's the AXMAX Baucus page. That's for my campaign to unseat Baucus
right.
in 2014.
Sounds like a noble cause.
Well, the Progressive Democrats of America are fully behind it, so.
Yes.
Well, we are really Progressive Democrats. No, we both know that.
I think I'm one of them. Yeah. I don't think the Democratic Party really exists anymore, and just for the reasons that you explained. So I don't identify as a Democrat. I identify more as a humanist progressive.
Right.
Or a socialist Democrat.
It's not a football game. You can't have loyalty to a team full of criminals. It's kind of like professional sports. When the Trailblazers in Portland became the Jailblazers, a lot of us walked away. We just got disgusted.
Right.
This isn't sport. These are not our heroes. So we walked away, and I think the Democrats need to do the same thing because
mm-hmm.
their party leaders have betrayed them.
And
they sold out to the corporate interests that bought the Republican Party and long time ago.
Exactly. And I just want to say that if listeners want to hear more about Rick's political views, my sister show, You Think, is a good place to go, because you're going to be on that show some more, I hope, right?
I sure hope so.
Because I know
also,
you're welcome.
I have two websites I should mention.
Okay.
Stegenborg for U.S. Senate.com and Soldiers for Peace International.com.
Wonderful. And this just goes to show you, when you have, I really believe that people with very high IQs have more energy than others. And if you have all that brain power, it's really important to do something with it and to be productive with it and also to contribute with it. And I see you doing that, and I want to thank you so much for joining me on this show. And, you know, there will be a podcast available that you can put on wherever you want. You can use it so people can know a little bit more about you personally.
I think I'll put it on my Facebook site.
Very good. Very good. So I want to just thank you so much, Rick, for sharing all this great stuff. And I know we could go on longer. Maybe I'll have to have you back again. And maybe we can break down some of the topics and get in more depth with them.
I'd really enjoy that.
Okay.
And I encourage people to go to the Soldiers for Peace International website. It links to the button says Take Back America. That's the name of the nonprofit I established to support it. Take Back America for the People. And that takes them to the collection of essays I call Stop the Madness.
Wonderful. Okay, Rick. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you, Michelle.
And we'll talk to you soon. Get back to driving now.
Yeah, I better get home to my wife or she'll be hopping mad.
You bet. Okay. Thanks so much. Thanks. See you. Bye-bye. So that was Rick Stagenborg. What an interesting fellow. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, it's quite interesting stuff, huh?
My head is spinning, I'm telling you.
Yeah, no, the guy is like super, super bright. And, you know, it's important to know that people who are that bright and that courageous can often be seen as being a little bit nutty. But I think he very adequately explained that that's not the case with him.
Well, I believe, you know, there's some people that refer to intellectuals as snobs. There's not a snobbish cell in his body.
No. The guy, he's really a great guy, and I hope he will be able to join us on, you think, some more.
Oh, I definitely.
Great. Okay, well, I guess we should sign off, huh? What do you say?
That sounds like a deal to me. Thank you so much for this. Is going to be episode number 3 of Happy Talk. The podcast will be available later this evening.
Okay, great. And I'll put that up on the Happy Talk fan page.
Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Michelle. Bye.
Sure. Bye.
This has been episode number 3 of Happy Talk with Michelle's guest, Senate candidate Rick Stagenborg of Oregon. Happy Talk airs at 7 p.m. Eastern on BlueRootsRadio.com. You can find the podcast at iTunes and at BlueRootsRadio.com. Just click the Happy Talk link at the top of the page. Thanks for listening.